Well, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Marcia Stone, and I'm an alcoholic. It's so good to be here with y'all. I was so excited about this. I've got a deep love in my heart for Austin Recovery and everything it stands for. I remember back in the day when Austin Recovery was on Cross Park, and we would always fight over who got to have the service commitment at Austin Recovery on Saturday morning. But I'm a tenacious alcoholic, so lots of times I got that spot. And I figured out this little trick back then, because back then the women's program, I might be telling this wrong, Will, but forgive me, but in my mind at least, the women's program and the family program were all together. So we'd have this big meeting on Saturday morning, like a 12-step meeting with the women and the children. And the children were children, right? They were talking, they were laughing, they were crying. But I was very serious about my recovery commitment, so I figured out this strategy. And I would go buy Round Rock Donuts every Saturday morning on the way down to Austin Recovery and give donuts to the children so we could all talk. And it was great, and they loved that. So I've loved Austin Recovery for a long time, and I'm really grateful to be here. Thank you, Chris, for asking me and whoever else was involved in that decision-making process. Anytime I'm asked to do anything for my recovery, I always try my best to say yes. I'm a little tired this morning. I flew in from Nashville last night about midnight. I was just working there this past week. So if I'm not quite as spunky as you were hoping for, please forgive me for that. I'll say that on the front end. My sobriety date's May 6, 2008, and my sponsor is a woman named Katie P. I think she still comes out here some. I don't know if y'all know Katie, but she's spunky enough for both of us, and I love her so much. She's been my sponsor since I first got sober, and, you know, I think one of the things that I'm going to talk about today is what it's like to be a mom in recovery and what it's like to be a mom that loses your children to your addiction, and I know all about that, and Katie walked me through that whole process of love and loss and redemption of our family. And I think it's really important for women, especially when you're so, when you come to the rooms of recovery and you've got so much shame and so much guilt, and of course it's not only women, but that's just my personal experience. I think it's very important that you get together with a woman who you can share every single thing about you, all of the regrets, all of the things that you think that you're going to take to your grave, and get really honest with that one person and have that spiritual consent. You know, the first step is about admitting, right, that we're powerless. And the spiritual principle behind the first step is honesty, and that was something that I had no conception of when I came here. I lied because I needed to lie to protect my behavior, to protect my disease, to keep away from confrontation. And so one of the first things that I had to do was learn how to be honest. And the big book talks about rigorous honesty. You know, sometimes before I'm going to talk, I look through my big book, and I see if anything comes to my mind. And I did that this morning. I sat in my car for a few minutes. And I want to read to you guys from just a couple of paragraphs from A Vision for You, because it made me think about this reunion. It made me think about what Austin Recovery stands for. In the middle of the page, it says, "Someday he or she will be unable to imagine life either with alcohol or without it. Then he will know loneliness such as few do." I was very familiar with loneliness. "He will be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end. But we have shown you how we got out from under. You say, 'Yes, I'm willing.' But am I to be consigned to a life where I shall be stupid, boring, and glum like some righteous people I see? I know I must get along without liquor, but how can I? Have you a sufficient substitute?" And then this is the part that I love so much. It says, "Yes, there is a substitute, and it is vastly more than that. It is a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you." So first of all, I just wanted you all to give yourself a hand for being here, for being in recovery, for finding the fellowship that we've been craving for so long. You know, alcoholism is this disease of isolation, and it's a disease of perception. And I know a lot about that. And if my perception gets skewed long enough, I'm going to be really isolated once again. And if I'm isolated and I'm miserable long enough and I'm focused too much on the way I'm feeling, I know exactly what to do. And I've known it for a very long time to change the way that I feel. And, you know, the book talks about that that's what we're doing. Alcohol, we drink for the effect produced. Some of us come here because we have a lot of pain. Some of us come here because we have a lot of trauma. Some of us came here because we were experimenting and things got out of hand. But whatever brings you here, you know, alcoholism and addiction, at least in my experience, is this disease of disconnectedness. And I love events like this because we can come together and we can have this common problem and this common solution, and we can experience connectedness in a very powerful way. So again, I'm very grateful to be here. I'm from, if you can't tell, I have a little bit of a southern accent, not quite a Texas accent. I was born and raised in South Georgia. My whole family lives there. We got some Georgia people here? All right, hey. I was born and raised in South Georgia in a small town. Pretty much all my family was from that town. So I had this big extended family. There's a lot of love in my family, but my parents got divorced when I was a little girl. I was about 3 years old when they got divorced. And so in order to compensate for that, what my family did was I visited a lot of people. So sometimes I'd stay with my mom, and sometimes I'd stay with my dad. Sometimes I'd stay with my grandparents. Sometimes I'd stay with my aunt and uncles. And mind you, they all lived in about a 20-mile radius. It was a small farming community. My family were tobacco farmers and lawyers. So, you know, in recovery, I've learned to distinguish facts from feelings. So the fact was that no one in my family had gotten divorced before. And so there was this little bitty girl, and I had this big family that loved me, and they all wanted to see me. So the fact was that I was visiting a lot of people that loved me. But the feeling was, in this little budding alcoholic, the feeling was that I didn't belong anywhere. And that feeling was devastating to me. And that feeling sort of grew as I grew. And it felt like I was a burden. And it felt like I didn't belong. It felt like I wasn't loved. It felt like I was rejected. It felt like I was abandoned. All of those things that ended up showing up in my four-step inventory when I did that many, many years later. But when we have those feelings, and I think for most of us, they probably started when we were younger. You know, they started before we ever put a drink or a drug into our body. And the feeling for me grew, and it got very painful and very uncomfortable. And the first thing that I did to compensate for that feeling was I became an overachiever. If there was anything to be involved in school, I signed up for it. I was going to volunteer for it. If there was a class trip to go on, I was going on the trip. I was on the committee. I was in the choir. I was doing the musicals. I was at every football game, all those kind of things. You know, in the big book, it talks about selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our problem, and we're driven by 100 forms of fear and self-delusion and self-pity and self-seeking. So that drivenness, at least in my experience, showed up in workaholism and overachievement. I felt like I had to work twice as hard to be half as good. I started drinking in high school. I was also a serial monogamist. You know, I always had to have a boyfriend. And I had to have a back pocket plan for when that relationship fell apart. I know some of the ladies in here can identify with that. So I was always having a boyfriend, and I was always busy, and then I started drinking in high school. You know, at the time, it seemed like my drinking looked like all my friends drinking. And what I learned later on, when I started going to therapy and when I started going to treatment, was at that time, alcohol was doing something for me that it wasn't doing for my friends. They were just drinking. They were just having a good time. Conviviality, joy, party. But for me, when I took that drink, that first drink of alcohol, long before I ever started doing drugs, I felt like my shoulders could come all the way down. I felt like I could articulate what I was thinking. I felt like I could come out and talk and dance and have a good time and be 100% present to the moment, just like that meditation that Chris did, and 100% involved. You know, it felt like if I was over here and you all were way over there, that huge chasm that represented the separateness of my life, alcohol allowed me to walk across the room. I started having some small consequences, but like I said, I lived in a small town, and, you know, there was a lot of layers and barriers of enabling that kept me from getting in any real trouble. I went off to college when I was 17 years old. I went to college in Virginia because it was the college that was furthest away from home. I wanted to get out of my small town. I was running. I was driven. I was looking just around the corner. It seemed like something was going to make me happy. It started like, if I get that car when I'm 16, I'm going to be happy. If he asks me to the prom, I'm going to be happy. If I get into the college that I want to get into, I'm going to be happy. If I get invited to the cotillion, I'm going to be happy. But it was always elusive, and happiness was always right around the corner, but I sure was involved in chasing it. 2 years after I was in college, the guy that I was dating at the time had graduated from Virginia Military Institute. I went to an all-women's college, and he went to an all-men's military school. And after my sophomore year in college, we decided that we were going to go down to the Outer Banks of North Carolina for beach week. And I don't know if there's anybody from North Carolina here, but the Outer Banks is the furthest-most region off the coast of North Carolina where they have all the surfing competitions and, you know, all the parties and all the cool kids hung out, at least in the 80s it was. I'm dating myself now. But we went to Nag's Head Beach for a week, and I liked it so much, and I discovered all kinds of substances that helped me to drink more than I already knew how to drink. And it was such a wonderful time that that 1 week vacation turned into 8 years of my life. Now, I don't know if you guys can relate to that, but when you find where the party is and you find what feels good to you, you sit all the way down, right? When you find that group of friends that's doing it exactly like you want to do it, and they're staying up as late as you want to stay up, and they're doing all the wild things that you want to do, I'm going to continue to hang out with them, and that's exactly what happened. So I ended up marrying this guy. He became my first husband, obviously. He was my best drinking buddy. I was 19 at the time. And by the time I was 24 years old, we'd had 3 children together. So I had 3 kids under the age of 4. And his alcoholism and his addiction was really taking off, so he did what we do. He got scared and he went home to his mom in Virginia. So I find myself 24 years old, living on the Outer Banks of North Carolina, 1,000 miles from everybody that I know and love, that I grew up with, scared to death, with no income, no education really, I had not completed college, and trying to figure out what was I going to do. And that was really the first time that I can remember in my life that that abject terror that we become so familiar with as the drinking goes on, that it really gripped me. Because I didn't know it at the time, but I had this healthy case of alcoholism percolating. You know, I've thought about so many times, when did I cross that invisible line? When was it the point of no return? When did I really begin to experience the physical allergy and the mental obsession? And I don't really know when that was exactly, but I know the first time that I experienced fear in a way that felt like it was from the top of my head to the tip of my toes, and it was then. And I was so alone. And the idea came to me that what I should do is I should apply for a scholarship to go to law school, because I remembered that I had won a debate competition when I was in high school, and that seemed like a reasonable thing to do. I had no money. I was on food stamps. My children were on Medicaid. I had no idea what to do. So I figured I was kind of the poster child for someone that would get a scholarship to go to law school. The problem was I had not finished college. So I applied for some grants, and I commuted to a small college near the beach, finished my degree, and I actually did get a scholarship, and I packed up those children, and I went to Durham, North Carolina, and I entered law school in 1996 as a single mom with 3 little kids and not an idea in the world what I was getting into. During the years of 1996 to 1999, my drinking really started to take off. You know, I did not know a thing about alcoholism, even though it was littered throughout my entire family tree. Nobody talked about it. It was the South. You didn't talk about those things. If anyone got drunk, no one mentioned it the next day. If anyone ran off and left their family or abandoned their children or put their family in financial ruin, it was never traced back to alcoholism. And if it was, the messaging that we got growing up was, if he loved his family, he'd stop drinking. And if your daddy cared about you, he'd show up on time to pick you up. And that's what I thought was going on within me, because in the years of 96 to 99, my drinking started to really escalate. Where's Chris? Is this, can I talk about drugs here? Okay, all right. I wasn't sure. And I had a real healthy cocaine habit. There's my people. Now y'all are with me. But I thought I was just stressed out, you know. I remember specifically one day, I was standing in my kitchen in Durham, North Carolina, and I would drink out of coffee cups because I didn't want my children to know how much I was drinking. And I was pouring liquor or wine or something into a coffee cup, and it was morning. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning. And my little boy, who's 27 years old today, he walked in the room. He was about 5 or 6 years old at the time. And when I looked down at that little boy, I saw that his pants did not reach his shoes. His pants were too small for him. And I saw that his shirt didn't reach his belt line. His shirt was too short for him. And I saw that he needed a haircut. His hair was too long. And for a moment in time, you know, I had this little brief moment of clarity, and it sounded like, I'm buying alcohol and I'm buying drugs and I'm not taking care of my children. But, you know, this disease that we have is so cunning and so baffling and so powerful that within a nanosecond, my next thought was, Marcia, you're stressed out. You're a single mother in law school. Anybody in your situation would need to drink like you're drinking. It would need the support of cocaine to have enough energy to do what you need to do every single day. And the second thought was, as soon as I'm finished with law school, as soon as I pass the bar, as soon as I have a job and I'm earning decent money, I'm going to take care of these children. And all of this will be a distant memory, and it will be, you know, a means to an end, so to speak. You know, one of the things that happened to me when I was little was my mom got remarried, and she married her divorce attorney. I've already done the inventory on that. I'll give y'all a second. Y'all can catch up with me on that one. But he was an abusive man, you know. He was very abusive to me, and my mom turned her head and looked the other way. So I made up my mind when I had my children that nothing, absolutely nothing, would stand in the way of me providing for them and caring for them and nurturing them and protecting them. And I meant that thing, and I could have passed a polygraph test about it. But as my alcoholism and my addiction continued to worsen, I became that mother that I hated. I became that mother that I judged. I wasn't turning my head on someone else's behavior. I was turning my head on my own behavior. Because I was that mother that would say, kids, I'm going to run down to the store and get a gallon of milk or get a loaf of bread, and I'll be right back. And right back turned into about 48 hours, many a time. And I had a daughter that was a little older than her brother. And she picked up the slack and took care of those children a lot. And that's not something that I'm proud of, but it is something that I talk about very freely. And I talk about it freely for a couple of reasons. Number one, I feel like it's my duty and my obligation. For any mom who's sitting in this room or who's listening to this, I don't know if y'all are recording this, because we all do those things that we regret, and we all do those things that we would never do, because if you become as seriously alcoholic and addicted as I was, you are powerless over what you are doing. And because I understand powerless at a very deep level, I can stand up and I can talk to anybody. I talked on the steps of the Capitol one day and stood up and said, and I'm Marcia Stone and I'm an alcoholic, and here are the things that I did, and these are representative of my illness, and they are not representative of who I am. But things went from bad to worse, as you can probably imagine. I did graduate by the skin of my teeth, and I moved back home. And I got a job, not because of my good grades, but because of my family connections. I was the first female assistant district attorney in the Southern Judicial District of Georgia. And what that means, are there some people in this room who have been to court, who's had trouble with the law? I was not the one that was on your side. I was the one that was walking up to the judge and recommending sentences for people like you and people like me. Because, you see, I was doing the very things at night that I was recommending sentences for during the day. Drinking and driving, neglecting my children, writing bad checks, possession of drugs. All those things that we do. And, you know, the big book talks about it. When I read this in the big book, it was like, oh, my God, that's me. It says, more than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He has this reputation that he wants to enjoy. But inside, he knows he doesn't deserve it. And that's that conflict. And that brings, and that makes for more drinking is what the book talks about. And that was my experience. By that time, I was drinking. If I was awake, I was drinking. I would wake up in the middle of the night to drink, to take the shakes off. I did shots of vodka before I went to court. I did cocaine in the courthouse. I did cocaine in my office before I saw clients. I was the worst example of what I could have ever dreamed about that I might turn out to be. And I had no idea how to stop, even though I desperately wanted to. And, you know, back then, my mom and some of my family members kind of knew what was going on, and they would come over to my house, and they would yell at me, and they would shake their finger at me, and they would shame me, and they would say the things that I'd heard growing up, which is, Marcia, if you loved your children, you wouldn't do this. And I believed them. Marcia, if you appreciated your job and all the sacrifices we've made for you, you wouldn't do this. And I took that in, and I believed them. Marcia, if you loved me, if you loved your dad, if you loved your family, you wouldn't be doing those things. And I absorbed all that information, and I believed it. But here's what I have to tell you. My mom was wrong. My family was wrong. I desperately wanted to stop. But by then, for sure, I had crossed that line. I had crossed that line, and I was unable to stop, no matter how great the wish or the desire. But, you know, consequences have a way of happening to people like us. And I got into a really bad car accident, and I was drinking, and I was driving, and there was bottles in my car and all kinds of stuff. And there was it was a small town. There wasn't a whole lot going on, so they put that story on the front page of the newspaper. And my mom has never been more ashamed in her life. So that day when the story printed, my whole family came over. My aunt was a probate judge, and my whole family came over, and they said to me, Marcia, you're going to go to treatment. And if you don't go to treatment, we're going to take your children away from you. So I went to treatment, right? That's what we do. I was not at the place yet where I was really willing to look at my own relationship with alcohol and my own relationship with drugs. Because that's what I love about recovery. It gives us the dignity to diagnose ourselves. But we've got to be at the point where we got no more ideas. We got to be at that point where we're out of ideas and out of options. And that's where God can show up. And that's where recovery can show up. But I wasn't there yet. I was still blaming. I was still finger pointing. My first husband was an ass because he left me. And he cheated on me. And he was abusive. My stepfather was abusive. Mom turned the other way. My job is stressful. My kids are hard. All those things, right? Because I was convinced still that if you had my life, you would drink like I was drinking. And you would do drugs like I was doing drugs. I was unwilling to admit that my problems were coming from inside of me and my belief systems and my unwillingness to do anything different or take any direction. This was a 90-day treatment program. I stayed for 88 out of the 90 days, and I left with what was to be my new husband. Because if you take away the drugs and you take away the alcohol, I still need to change the way I feel. So if you're in this treatment center, I don't know if there's any current clients here, and you're thinking it's a good idea to leave with Mr. or Mrs. right now, pause. Pause when agitated, even if you're not doubtful, right? So we left together and set up shop together in North Carolina. I got my license to practice in North Carolina. He is a veterinarian. We're actually still married, but not before we suffered a horrific relapse together. We set up shop in Asheville, and my kids came, and he has a son from a previous marriage, and we ended up having a son together. So now I have 5 children in this blended family. And from 2002, when I got out of treatment the first time, and 2008, those 6 years, I was mostly sober, meaning that I wasn't actively drinking. I wasn't actively doing cocaine. But if I went to the dentist and he needed to give me a prescription and I needed to get it filled a few times, well, who wouldn't take that opportunity, right? And, you know, if Jonathan was out of town, I would go, like, buy a bunch of those little wines in the four packs. And, I mean, those don't really even count. They're, like, this big, right? But the whole time I was going to meetings, I had a sponsor. We didn't do any step work, but she did give me a baby shower. And she introduced me to sushi, which I liked a lot. So it was a good relationship, right? Dry. So one day in 2007, I'm sitting in my law office. By this time, I'm practicing criminal law. And this guy walks into my office, and he tells me he needs me to represent him because he's got a little assault ticket that he needs to get taken care of. And I said, all right, it'll be $500. And he said, I don't have that much money right now, Miss Stone. And I said, okay, well, what do you got? I mean, it was Western North Carolina. It was the winter. It was February. I thought we were going to trade, like, some firewood, you know, something. Something, I don't know, like a barter. He was a landscaper, so I thought maybe he was going to, you know, put some sod down. He said, what about an eight ball? And you know that story in the book about Jim, who's driving down the highway and he stops at the gas station to get a sandwich, and suddenly the thought occurs to him that a little whiskey in his milk won't hurt a thing? Suddenly, it raced through my mind that Jonathan, that's my husband, Jonathan's not helpful around the house. My kids are teenagers now. They're so ungrateful. My secretary calls out to work all the time, and I have to do everything, right? That's like the swan song of this alcoholic. I am chronically underappreciated, even to this day. I mean, that's something that I battle. And when he offered me that cocaine, suddenly it seemed like the best idea I'd ever had. So I took that cocaine and I took his case and I went to the bathroom in my law office and I did a line of that cocaine. And you know, I used to hear in meetings of AA and CA that my last drink lasted 18 months. And I thought, well, that's bull. Nobody can drink for 18 months. I'm telling you, from February 2007 to my sobriety date, May 6, 2008, if I was awake and not in detox or not in a psych hospital or not in a jail, I was high, getting high, sleeping it off, or trying to find more. It became like a full-time job. And things went downhill very, very quickly. About 3 months before I got sober, we went out one night to get some cocaine, and they didn't have any powder cocaine. And this guy said to me, actually said to my husband, here, just take this rock, just smoke this. It's just as good. And if I start talking about the rock, you know my story's almost over, right? Within 90 days, the Bar Association came in and ordered me to go to treatment and locked the doors on my law office. The North Carolina Veterinary Board did the same thing to my husband and locked his hospital up. Our babysitter called Child Protective Services on us, and they came and took possession of our 5 children. Our house was foreclosed on. My car was repossessed. My husband's car was repossessed. I spent every dollar that I had in the bank and stole about $18,000 from a real estate account that I had for my clients. My children were left unsupervised way more than they were supervised. By this time, my daughter was in 11th grade, and she was basically taking care of her brothers full time. In 3 short months. When I say that I started smoking crack cocaine, I did it like it was a full-time job. That's about the only way to do it, in my experience. There's not a lot of time in the day for anything else. And people say to me when they hear me talk, they're like, you don't look like a cocaine addict. You don't look like you would smoke crack. And I'm like, what does a drug addict look like? Tell me that. Because I have blonde hair, because I have white skin. What does a drug addict look like besides someone who's walking around with a broken heart and has figured out a way to cover that up I'm so grateful for every drink I ever drank. I'm so grateful for every line I did and for every rock I smoked, and here's why. It kept me alive long enough until I could find the rooms like this and find a treatment center that understood what was going on with me and began to tell me the truth about alcoholism and addiction so that I could get connected with power and not have to act like that and go against my value system anymore. So the Bar Association did an intervention on me and sent me to a long-term gender-specific treatment center in Atlanta, Georgia. And basically what they said is, if you stay here, you have a shot at getting your kids back, and you have a shot at getting your license back. I was mad at my husband. I felt like this was all his fault, so I didn't care if he came back at the time. Right? You got to point the finger at somebody. But what happened when I was there is a pretty miraculous thing. I talk to people all the time about, you know, sending their son or daughter or wife or husband to treatment, and they say things like, but he or she doesn't want to go. He or she hasn't hit rock bottom. He or she, you know, they need to ask for it for themselves. They need to be wanting to do this for themselves. That is not my experience. I did not think I could get sober. By this time, I'd been to 3 different treatment centers and untold amount of detoxes. I felt like I was one of those people that was constitutionally incapable. I didn't read the last of that sentence that said constitutionally incapable of being honest with yourself. Remember when I told you at the beginning of this talk, I had to start getting honest. All I wanted to do was get my kids back, and all I wanted to do was get my law license back. And for those 2 reasons, and those 2 reasons only, I sat down in that treatment center and I began to take direction. My first higher power looked a lot like my counselor. Because about 20 days into that treatment, I decided that I needed to leave. I decided that this place wasn't for me. I really decided that I felt like I couldn't get sober and that my kids were better off without me, that my husband was better off without me, that I should just resign my license forever, that my parents could raise my children and everybody would be better off without me. That's what I decided. Does that sound familiar to anybody in here? Because that is a lie of our disease. We have this disease that wants us dead, but will settle for us drunk or high or miserable, but for sure alone. That is addiction. At least that's what it did to me. So I decided I wanted to leave, and my good friend that I'm still friends with today, she came over to my room and she said, Marcia, it's late. I don't think you should do that. I think you should think about this tomorrow. And I agreed with her. It was late, and I only had $50 to my name, and I felt like maybe I should sleep on it. And that night before I laid down to go to bed, with tears coming down my eyes, bawling my eyes out and crying out to this God that I'd heard about my whole life but had no relationship with whatsoever. I mean, I grew up in South Georgia. It was Jesus and sweet tea. I mean, that's what it was, right? And I knew all about God. I knew all the Bible stories. I've been off to the Bible schools. I knew all that stuff. But I had no idea that God cared about me or cared about whether or not I was drinking or cared about whether or not I was doing drugs. I felt like God had bigger things to worry about than whether or not I was going to be drunk or high that day. But that night as I was crying, I was led to this line in a book. And it was actually a relapse. It was like a book about relapse that happened to be sitting there in that room. And I opened that book, and this line jumped out at me. It said, if you think you are constitutionally incapable of sobriety, you are wrong. And if you find yourself in a treatment setting, you have one job to do, and that is roll up your sleeves and do the work. And that was my first spiritual experience. I don't know if it was real. I don't know if it was coincidence. I don't know if it was luck or happenstance, and it doesn't matter to me because at the time, I felt from the top of my head to the tip of my toes that there was a power greater than me out there somewhere that knew my name. So the next day, I marched down to my counselor's office where I went to treatment. We kind of like lived in apartments, and then we had to walk to school during the day. And I marched down there, you know, my ego was still pretty intact, so I had my backpack on, and I knocked on the door and went in her office, and her name was Kendall. And I said, Kendall, And I told her what had happened the night before. I told her how I'd opened the book, and I was just, you know, willing to do the work, and I felt like it was kind of a sign and all this stuff. And I said, Kendall, listen, I'm going to stay here as long as you tell me to stay here. I'm going to do everything you tell me to do. I'm not going to leave until you tell me I'm healed and I'm ready. And if I leave this place after doing everything you tell me to do, and I drink again, it is your fault. And thank God, she said, she stuck out her hand, she said, I'll take that deal. And from that day to this day, I am very, very good at taking direction when it comes to my recovery. Very, very good at it. Not because I'm some virtuous person. I've kind of laid out all my, you know, poor choices and bad behavior to you all. The reason I'm really good at taking direction is because I finally got honest with myself, and I have a deep understanding of my first step truth. Without power, it's not a matter of if I'm going to drink or if I'm going to do cocaine or if I'm going to smoke crack again. It's not a matter of if without power. It's a matter of when. And my experience bears that out for me time and time and time again. No matter the consequences, no matter the desire, no matter the swears, no matter the promises to myself or others, the only thing that keeps me separate and protected and in a position of neutrality is a relationship with this power that's greater than me that started that day. The treatment center that I went to wasn't really a big 12-step treatment center. I got into the 12 steps after I moved to Texas. And really what happened when I was on my knees and crying and going down and making that commitment to my counselor, I was working the first three steps during that 24-hour period. I was making a decision to turn my will and my life over to her at that moment. I had come to believe that I needed a power. I sure as heck knew that I was powerless. But you know, the big book says, when we take that third step, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that the wording is quite optional. And that was certainly my experience. So I stayed there. I was in treatment for about 7 months. So anyone who's here for 30, 60, 90 days, I don't want to hear it. My children were staying with my mom down in South Georgia, and my husband actually came to Austin and went to a recovery center here in Austin. Not Austin Recovery, but a different one. And we decided, with the help of our counselors and our sponsors, and, you know, I always say, the more people that are interested in your recovery, the better. The more open and transparent you can be about your secret thoughts, your back pocket plans, your lurking notions, the better. Be honest. Say I'm scared. Say I don't want to stay. Say I don't want to do those steps. It doesn't matter how you feel. It just matters what you do. And a lot of times when I'm honest about what I'm feeling or what I'm thinking with another person who's armed with the facts about alcoholism and addiction, it takes the power out of those thoughts, right? So we started getting really honest, and this whole team of people helped us to construct a plan where I was going to move to Austin and we were going to come back together. And we were going to start to prepare our home for our children to come back. And it was going to be a long process. I didn't have custody of my children for a year. And it was painful. I had so much remorse about the way I had treated them. And so much regret about all the opportunities and the moments lost. I can remember walking up to the med line and I felt like my arms were aching. And I needed to take ibuprofen because I missed my baby so much. But anyway, I ended up moving down to Texas, and we started to do things differently. You know, this was the same guy that I had left treatment with years ago. And one thing I know for sure is recovery does not ride a tandem bicycle. It's totally fine if you're in a relationship with someone else that's in recovery, but they are not your sponsor. They are not your higher power. They are not your accountability partner. They're none of that. They're someone that you love, and let them stay in that department. I started to form a recovery community with other women here. I worked intensively with my sponsor and went through all the steps. I started to help others. I started to really develop a prayer and meditation practice. And I started to fall in love with this thing of recovery. You know, I wanted so badly to have my children back way before they came back. But, you know, there's a promise in the third step, and that promise says, when we stay close to God and perform his work well, he will provide what we need. And that really appealed to the lawyer mind that I had. That's like a contract, right? I'm going to stay close to God and perform his work well, and he's going to provide what I need. And what I need are not the tangible things that I think I need, like a car, like a savings account, like a new purse. What I need is this relief from the bondage of Marcia that has run my life for so long and catapulted me into self-will and catapulted me into fear-based decisions. So if I am relieved from that bondage of self, then all of a sudden I'm taking my hands off of situations and allowing God and the process and my higher power and the universe to work things out in the exact right time. So every time I thought about getting a lawyer to try to get my kids back, every time I thought about trying to get on the phone with my mom and guilting her into letting me have them back sooner, I was reminded of that, and my thoughts and my actions were redirected to finishing my steps, finishing all my amends, paying all the money back, helping all the people I could, showing up to Austin Recovery on Saturday morning with Round Rock Donuts that I couldn't really afford because I wanted to help God's other kids and to talk to them about this recovery experience that I had had that had completely revolutionized my life. You know, the book talks about that we have to have a psychic change sufficient to overcome alcoholism, and that's exactly what happened to me. So about a year after my sobriety date, so about May 2009, I get a call from my mom one day, and she says, it's time for you all to come get your children, right out of the blue. So my husband and I borrowed somebody's Ford Explorer, and we drove down to South Georgia to pick up our young son and my middle son and my daughter. I don't know if you guys have ever seen that YouTube video about those two guys that adopted that lion. The lion's name is Christian. And the lion got too big for their apartment in London, so they released the lion onto this safari game reserve down in Africa. And about 2 years went past, and they wanted to go see Christian, this lion that they had raised as a cub. And all the lion trainers were saying, he's not going to remember you all. And my mom was saying, the kids may not be happy to see you. And my sponsor was saying, don't be surprised if they're standoffish at first. But my mom lived on a farm in South Georgia and had a long driveway. And we drove up that driveway. My son is 14 years old now, but at the time he was two, almost three. And he was riding one of those little John Deere tractors with the pedals, you know. They're heavy as lead. He could barely move it down the driveway. And when we rounded the curb and he saw us and he recognized us, he jumped off of that John Deere tractor and he threw that tractor down as hard as he could throw it. And he was running. And my baby was running from me. This baby that I had abandoned, that I had put drugs in my body over caring for him and giving him the food and the nurturing that he needed. This baby saw me, and he ran for his mom. And he held his arms up, and he said, Daddy. And that's recovery. That's recovery, and that's what happens when we begin to take direction. I did not want to stay in treatment for 7 months. I did not want to go without seeing my children. I did not want to write everything down on that fourth step. I did not want to make all the amends. I did not want to pay all the money back. To be honest, sometimes I don't even really feel like helping each other that much. But this is a program of action. This is a spiritual program of action. What we think or how we feel about the action that is prescribed in this program has little bearing on what the results will be if we participate in that action. I am standing here today. I have not had a drink. I have not had a drug. And I have not hurt my children in over 11 years. And that is because of one reason and one reason only. Honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness to go to any lengths. That's the truth. So we stayed in Austin, obviously. Jonathan got his veterinary license back. I started working in a totally different industry. I never got my law license back. I started working in the recovery business, actually. And my heart was just lit on fire for helping other people and sharing what is possible through my own experience. You know, I think that God shows up with skin on. And I remember early on when I was in recovery, I heard a woman talking about her story and talking about all the things that she had done and talking about getting her children back. And I thought to myself, that's what I want to do. That's what I want to do. And that is what I do. Our family is reunited. My children that were young when I was going through all that are all in their 20s now. All three of my older children are sober and in recovery now. It's genetic too, as we know. My marriage is on a different basis. And I can tell you without a shadow of a doubt that every single thing that is good in my life is because of my recovery. Everything. I was talking with a sponsee the other day, and she said, I don't really feel like I owe this person an amends for this, something she had done. And I said, well, here's my test for stuff like that. I think about what might happen if I was in a hotel and I got on an elevator and that person that's in question was on the elevator. Would I feel comfortable when those doors shut going up 15 floors, or would it be awkward? That's my litmus test. And I can tell you today, there is no one on the face of this earth that I would be uncomfortable in an elevator with. And that is nothing but the grace of God. I'm very grateful to be here. I know y'all are probably ready to go eat your lunch and listen to the band and all the fun stuff. Again, thank you all for having me. I love Austin Recovery. You guys are doing such amazing work out here. Thank you all for listening to me and let me share my heart about my recovery and about my relationship with God. Have a great reunion.